Why don't we start? Thank you all for coming. I'm Adam Ramsey. I'm the director of the Center for Medicine, Health, and Society. And I'd like to welcome you to our NHS Spring Lecture with Dr. Jill Fadagno. I want to begin by saying a few words about the NHS Center, which is sponsoring today's lecture with co-sponsorship from the Department of Sociology, the Ethics Center, and the Center for Biomedical Ethics and Society. The Center for Medicine, Health, and Society is intended as a new way to link the humanities and social sciences broadly defined to a major academic medical center. Although it's officially based in the College of Arts and Science, our 300-plus affiliates come from all 9 schools at Vanderbilt and from the Harry Medical College, Tennessee State University, and the Nashville healthcare community. Membership is open to all faculty, students, and healthcare providers who share an interest in studying health and healthcare in their social and cultural context. If you would like to join the center, please add your name to our sign-up sheet after the lecture. We'll put you on our electronic mailing list, and you will be free to participate as much or as little in the activities of the center as you wish. Before I introduce our speaker, I'd like to remind you that immediately following the lecture at 1:10, we will continue the discussion of all the important questions that the lecture raises upstairs in room 411. And later this afternoon, from 4:30 to 6, there will be a reception and book signing at the Vanderbilt Bookstore in Rand Hall. It is a pleasure to introduce a scholar who has contributed so much to an informed understanding of some of the major social issues of our day, and also to the fruitful interaction of the social sciences and public health. Since 1987, Dr. Fadagno has been the Mildred and Claude Pepper Eminent Scholar in Social Gerontology and Professor of Sociology at Florida State University. Before moving to Florida State, she was a member of the Department of Sociology at the University of Kansas, where she received her PhD in 1976. She has received numerous honors and awards, including fellowships from the American Council of Learned Societies and the John Simon Guggenheim Memorial Foundation. She was appointed a fellow of the Gerontological Society of America in 1992 and served as president of the American Sociological Association in 1997 to 98. Dr. Fadagno's research has been wide-ranging, embracing the sociology of aging, long-term care, medical sociology, among other fields. She is currently doing research on the religious basis of welfare state politics in the US, which was the subject of a lecture she gave yesterday at Vanderbilt on the other side of campus. Among her very numerous publications are 3 books and 6 edited or co-edited volumes on aging, retirement, and long-term care that include Aging in Early Industrial Society, Work, Family, and Social Policy in 19th Century England, published in 1982, The Transformation of Old Age Security, Class and Politics in the American Welfare State, 1988, and Aging and the Life Course, 1999. In 1994, she published a prize-winning book entitled The Color of Welfare, How Racism Undermined the War on Poverty. Her talk for us today is based on her most recent book, published last year by Oxford University Press, and copies will be available at the book signing this afternoon at the Vanderbilt Bookstore. It has the punchy title, One Nation Uninsured, Why the U.S. Has No National Health Insurance. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Jill Fadagno.
Thank you. I'm very delighted to be talking to a group in the medical community of doctors, I gather, and medical students. Let me just tell you a little bit about how I got involved in a study of the national health insurance issue, because it was kind of a shifting in my career interests. About a dozen years ago, when I was on sabbatical from my regular teaching position, I got a fellowship to work in Congress on any kind of committee that I could get hooked up with. And at that time, a commission was just starting called, this was during President Clinton's administration, called the Bipartisan Commission on Entitlement and Tax Reform. And so I got a position on the staff. And I'll never forget my first day when I walked in. I was working for Senator Bob Kerry. He was my boss. And I was really starstruck when I walked into the Hart Senate office building. And you know, it's just amazing to have this opportunity to actually work in the Senate. And my very first day on the job, as I walked through the front door, there was this crowd buzzing around the elevator. And I thought, what could this be? You know, maybe it's a senator, perhaps it's even President Clinton. And so I kind of walked forward, trying to squeeze in and see what was going on in the center. And just as I did that, the crowd parted, and out trotted Bob Dole's dog with a lowly staff member in tow out for his morning constitutional. So that was my first brush with the power elite. By the time our commission ended about 6 months later, this was in 1994, the Democrats had lost control of Congress. President Clinton's plan was totally dead. And the staffers who had been too busy to answer my calls in the summer were now calling me to ask if my university had any job openings. Shortly after, I began to think, why was it that President Clinton was really unable to succeed in a goal that seemed so worthwhile, providing universal health insurance, that everybody should have insurance, seemed like such a smart idea to me. And around the same time, a more personal event happened that made me really interested in this issue. My sister, who had been working in the banking industry, lost her job when First Interstate Bank that she had worked with was bought out by Wells Fargo, and she was one of the many casualties of these banking mergers, and her family's health insurance had been through her job. And while they would have COBRA continuation coverage, it was extremely expensive with one person unemployed. And so she started looking around to find health insurance that would cover her family at a reasonable rate. And she found some policies for herself and her two children, but nobody would insure my brother-in-law because 6 years earlier he had had a cancer scare. And even though he was totally healthy now, he was, in insurance industry jargon, uninsurable. And when I talked to friends about my sister's problem, nearly everybody had a similar story of someone they knew, someone close to them, someone in their family. And I thought at the time, how can it be that people with seemingly secure lives, and I had always thought that the lack of health insurance was mainly a problem of low-income people, and while that is where the majority, low-wage workers are the majority of the uninsured, that it's a risk that everybody shares potentially at some point in their life course, losing a job, losing your spouse, as one of my friends who was widowed found out, or just getting sick. And so for the next 4 years, I shuffled through lots of documents. I interviewed a lot of people along the way. And I ended up writing this book, and excuse this shameless plug, but I love the cover that my publisher came up with. I felt I was struggling to find a photo, and they thought of this idea, and I thought it perfectly captured the problem. You know, and so the question I really sought out is why, when the right to health care is guaranteed, it's recognized in international law, and it's guaranteed in the constitution of many countries. And there's no single way that countries provide universal coverage, and yet all other countries in the Western world, with the exception of South Africa, have universal health insurance of people were uninsured for some period of time, which is not a problem if you're healthy, but just have one thing go on in your life and you realize what a big problem that can be. And even though other countries allow some private insurance to have some role, universal coverage doesn't mean excluding the private insurance industry. They all, in some ways, regulate the practices of the private insurance industry so that the kind of medical underwriting practices that are commonly employed in the United States to set premiums, deny coverage, and skim off the more desirable employer groups and individuals are not allowed. And that's my question. Why is the United States the only country where we have 46 million people without coverage, where you can lose your insurance if you lose your job, and where we have this complex system of public programs for the elderly and for the poor, and then other people that are tied only through their jobs to the health insurance system? There have been a number of explanations about why this might be the case. One is that it's just basically that Americans prefer it this way, that we don't want the government to strongly intervene in any kind of social policy issues, that we have these deeply embedded values. Or another argument is that the labor movement in the United States has never taken the kind of role that it's taken in other countries of forming a labor party and then promoting national health benefits, or even that we have a political system that makes it really difficult to get anything done. Any legislation has to go through congressional committees and then be signed off on by both the House and the Senate, and then be signed by the President, and all along the way there are many kind of veto points where various groups can get in the way of any kind of major social policy initiatives. Or the other is that we just sort of set off on one path, which is towards private insurance for people of working age, and therefore accumulate too many embedded interests to move in a different direction. And I think there's an element of truth in all of these arguments, but also they can't explain then why we have a vast social security system that covers virtually all retirees, and why we have Medicare that covers almost all people over 65, and how we got the combination of programs that we have of Medicaid, Medicare, and private insurance benefits. So now, what is my take on this? Well, my first review of the historical evidence led me to think that the culprit was the American Medical Association. Now, it's certainly true that until the 1960s, the AMA was the most visible and vocal opponent of any kind of universal health benefits. And the AMA was a powerful professional association. And here's the point, that it had an organizational structure that was well suited to political action. At the top, there was the National House of Delegates, which could set policy. At the middle level, there were state medical societies. And then at the local level, there were local medical societies. And to be a member of the state medical society, you had to be a member of the local medical society. So there was this potential political action machine. And at every skirmish, at the state, local, and federal level, the AMA became very involved in opposing different plans for any kind of universal coverage. The goal was to erect a barrier between any kind of a third-party payer, and that's the irony when you think of the situation today, especially the government, that might intrude in the doctor-patient relationship, set fees, determine how physicians practice medicine. Now, from the beginning, there were always dissident individual physicians and small groups of doctors that many of them located in medical centers that supported various proposals along the way. But the AMA was the prime professional organization that had a variety of ways of levying influence on individual physicians. And I can talk about that in more detail later if you want. But way back in the progressive era, in the 1910s, when there was an attempt at the state level, we weren't even talking about federal action at that time for universal coverage in New York and in California, the plans got the farthest. Here's just a typical quote. This is from the president of the Medical Society of New York said, "If the profession is to save itself, it must organize as it has never organized before." During the Great Depression in the 1930s, when President Roosevelt considered including national health insurance as one part of the Social Security Act of 1935, the medical societies waged a battle, sent hundreds of letters opposing including that. Eleanor Roosevelt's own doctor lobbied her to tell her president the president was a bad idea. And President Roosevelt finally concluded, we can't go up against the state medical societies. We just can't do it. Now, in the 30s, there was virtually no kind of private insurance at that time. But forces were pushing towards some kind of an organized way to pay for health care. The Depression had placed a lot of pressure on hospitals. People just couldn't go to hospitals when they were sick because they had no way to pay for care. And so that's when the first Blue Cross plans were initiated. And even though the AMA initially fought against Blue Cross, when it became clear that a public momentum for some kind of public program wouldn't go away, then they accepted Blue Cross, and then later in that decade organized the Blue Shield plans. Now, when Harry Truman was elected, became president in 1940s, the worst fears of the American Medical Association were realized. Harry Truman made national health insurance one of the key domestic issues of his Fair Deal. And at that time, the AMA opened a Washington office to keep closer tabs on events. JAMA blasted this communist conspiracy that would destroy medicine. They levied a fee of $25, which was a lot of money at that time, on doctors to pay for a national education campaign, and organized every county medical society into a political action organization. Doctors were told to go to their local newspaper editors to write editorials against the Truman Plan. They were given speeches to use in public debates. The whole goal was to turn public opinion against the Truman Plan. The AMA also mobilized against any Democratic president candidates for office who supported Truman. For instance, in Pennsylvania in the 1950 election, there was a healing arts committee of doctors and dentists and office assistants who sent out over 200,000 letters and postcards. Doctors posted signs in their offices saying, do me a favor and go to the polls and vote for John Saylor in the next election. If you need a ride to the polls, we'll even drive you there. And six Democratic senators who supported President Truman were defeated in that election. And so my initial take on this was, wow, it seemed like the AMA was really an important factor. And yet, here's the question that I asked myself. Is it really possible that physicians, merely a professional group after all, like sociologists, could defeat the will of reformers, politicians, and even presidents for half a century? And the answer, I don't know if all of you have had to read this social Transformation of American Medicine by Paul Starr. But he says that the key to physicians' political influence in that period was what he calls the absence of a countervailing power. But I would argue the exact opposite, that it wasn't the absence of a countervailing power that made physicians appear like they were so politically influential, but rather the fact that the goals of the American Medical Association meshed with that of other groups with greater clout and deeper pockets. In the Progressive Era, physicians won their fight against the state plans because they had the support of the Chamber of Commerce, the National Association of Manufacturers, and Prudential Insurance Company, which was just at that time starting to think about whether private insurers should move into the market of insuring health care. They even in that period had the American Federation of Labor on their side. This same groups overall, with the exception of the labor movements, were supportive of the AMA and had the same goals during the Truman era. There was also support from some Republican members of Congress who wanted to roll back the whole New Deal, and from Southern Democrats who opposed any kind of a national health program that might allow the federal government to intervene in Southern hospitals and tell Southern hospitals they had to integrate, that they couldn't segregate African-American patients on separate floors or not allow them admission at all to the hospital. Now, the first real change occurred in 1955, where the AFL and the CIO merged into a single union and now wanted to show what a united labor movement could do. And one of their first goals was health insurance for the aged, what became Medicare. Now you might ask yourself, why Medicare? Why not pursue health insurance for everybody? And the answer is that once it was clear that Harry Truman was going to be blocked on national health insurance, that the labor unions began negotiating health benefits in their contracts with employers. And there was this huge boom in employee benefits, health benefits that were negotiated between 1945 and 1955. And so the unions now had something they could offer their members. But it was a problem with their retired members because they were more expensive to cover and they would have to give up wages in their negotiations if they also included health benefits. So it made sense pragmatically for the unions to support health benefits for older people. So there were a variety of tactics that the AFL-CIO, this was just from one of the publications of the AMA decrying the Truman Plan. The AFL-CIO began a big campaign, which took 9 years, writing model bills, getting legislators to sponsor those bills, educating their own members about the need for health insurance for older people. They created a separate organization called the National Council of Senior Citizens because what would it look like if the elderly weren't behind a program for health benefits for them? All of the tactics that the AMA had used against Truman in the 1940s were employed by the AFL-CIO in the 1950s and 1960s. And now the National Council of Senior Citizens was out there getting the press, setting the terms, explaining to people that Medicare was not socialized medicine, that it wouldn't be a big government takeover of the healthcare system. Now, where is the AMA in this battle? Well, it was as vehemently opposed to Medicare as it had been to Truman's plan in just two decades earlier. In fact, in one of the historical records that I was looking at, one senator's files, I found tons of letters from doctors opposing Medicare. Just one of them was he said that he told him he should be castrated and his progeny die in embryo. So that was pretty strong feelings against Medicare. But now the AMA had met its match in the AFL-CIO, which had a similar organizational structure, national leadership, state labor federations, local union members. It had the resources to influence public opinion and set priorities. But equally important, in this period, the AMA had lost key allies, one by one, like fighter jets peeling off in formation. One big defector was the insurance industry. Initially, insurers had offered 65-plus policies, or there were various needs like that for them, thinking they could head off a government program. But then they realized old people get sick, and this wasn't really a profitable group to insure. And so they started negotiating behind the scenes for ways that they could be a part of the new legislation. The AMA also lost the support of hospital administrators who were paying the bills, in many cases providing a lot of uncompensated care for older people, and who began to think that the opposition of the AMA was not serving their interests. And the AMA's hardball tactics also backfired in terms of public opinion. There were increasing numbers of letters to the editor and editorials of newspapers, you know, against the kind of tactics. And so it hurt the AMA in the long run. Now, Medicare was passed in 1965, and it was certainly a victory for reformers and for older people. But it was also, in a sense, a victory for the providers. First of all, there would be no limits on physicians' fees, and that was definitely a compromise to try to get doctors to comply with the law, because even if you put in a new health benefit, if people would in the healthcare industry would not cooperate, it would be hard to get it going. Hospitals would be allowed there to pay their usual charges plus 2%. Private insurance companies would administer Medicare. The original idea that it would be Blue Cross, but in many states there were other private insurance companies that were also came up with better proposals. And then there were these uncovered expenses that were left for Medigap policies to cover. So given this kind of arrangement, one policy person said it was like trying to close the barn door after the horse had already escaped. We saw substantial inflation in the healthcare sector immediately after Medicare was enacted. In 1965, just after the legislation went into effect, hospital charges jumped 17%, the fees of internists by 40%. Senator Ribicoff, who was one critic, said that public funds had spawned the civilian equivalent of the defense establishment. Both had an insatiable appetite for money and a well-developed talent for avoiding public accountability. So as healthcare costs skyrocketed, then the major purchasers of healthcare began to seek ways to control costs. And who were the major purchasers? Now it was the federal government, and it was employers who were purchasing health care and paying for health care for their employees. And so that was really the beginning of a war for control that continues until today, pretty much unabated. The first challenge came from the federal government. President Carter actually tried a hospital cost containment measure that went down to defeat. And the result was in 1983 was the beginning of the first kind of real controls, which was the prospective payment system, the DRGs that set a fixed amount for each hospital stay. And I think you have to understand the DRGs in terms of this whole history that came before them. And it was followed a few years later by a fee schedule for physician services, which in the long run have sort of immediately in the short term controlled costs, but not able to do so over the long term. But the bigger challenge really came from what were former allies, which were the large corporations and business organizations. By as early as the early 1980s, the business community was really alarmed about rising healthcare costs, which had increased 700% in a 10-year period. And this issue of costs and of access and of the number of uninsured became a really big issue in the 1992 election. And that was one of the key campaign promises that Bill Clinton made when he was out there seeking election. And this time, the main opposition was not from the AMA or the medical community. In fact, when I was reading, there was a whole cottage industry of books on the failure of the Clinton plan, and most of them, the AMA is not even mentioned in the index of the book. The main opposition to the Clinton campaign plan came from a coalition of the smaller insurance companies and small business organizations. Initially, it seemed that Clinton might have some business support because, especially from large manufacturers like the auto industry, where we're seeing a revival of these same problems today, not being swamped by their health care costs. But when the details of this plan emerged, there were things that they didn't like in it, and so they also turned against him. His biggest opponent was the Health Insurance Association of America, which represented these smaller insurance companies, and the National Federation of Independent Business. And independent businesses were really mostly concerned about the fact that there would probably be a tax increase. And for small businesses, any kind of tax increase is a huge impediment. The coalition spent $50 million on this advertising campaign. Some of you may remember the Harry and Louise ads of this couple sitting in a kitchen saying, "Oh, it's too bad the government's going to take away our ability to choose our own doctors, and the healthcare system will be run by government bureaucrats." It was amazing. The language was the exact same as was used in the 1940s. They set up SWAT teams and used insurance agents, became a kind of a grassroots social movement force against the Clinton plan. And so overall, over $100 million was spent to defeat the Clinton plan. There was thousands, 450,000 contacts with members of Congress from various organizations and individuals, whereas Clinton supporters raised only $15 million. When the first poll was taken on the Clinton plan, 59% of the public was in favor. Just 6 months later, that's when I was working in Washington, only 44% were in favor, and it never even came up for a vote. Now, what has happened since then is that health policy has moved towards, primarily towards shoring up the private health insurance system by tightening up regulations somewhat on insurance companies and by expanding coverage for certain groups, mainly through the state children's health insurance program and the prescription drug benefit for Medicare beneficiaries. But it's clear to me that, regardless of anti-statist values or the structure of the political system, that powerful groups, I just saw every story that I tried to pursue ultimately told the same tale, that powerful groups that were well-financed and well-organized were able to defeat every sort of attempt for any kind of universal coverage, even President Eisenhower's plan, modest plan in the 1950s. And these are just some of the ways then the outcomes of those battles helped to structure the current kind of private health benefits that we have today. The defeat of national health insurance in the 40s that encouraged the labor movement to work for benefits for their members directly. Medicare actually removed an important group that might have been a constituency for any kind of universal coverage and left behind this sort of disorganized fragments of political support that we see today. And then Clinton's failed plan led to more regulation that was really shores up the private insurance system, although there are just in the last 2 years, more and more employers are dropping coverage and retiree health benefits are going the way of the dinosaur. So what are the prospects for reform? And I must say when I finished the book, I was feeling pretty pessimistic. And my editor said, but you can't end on such a negative note. You know, what can you say? So I had to think a lot. I could see that both the AMA and the AFL-CIO were citizen groups that were organized in similar ways. And I think that it takes that kind of action with a national leadership, some kind of state organization, and then local people who can contribute grassroots activity to get any kind of significant legislation passed. And then what is up there now, though, is very little action at the federal level, except a plan that President Bush just talked about to expand HSAs, health savings accounts. But I did a lot of radio shows over the summer, and actually it was amazing to me how much activity is going on in the states. There are just tons of citizen groups out there working at the state level, and we have seen Maryland recently pass legislation telling very large employers that they either have to provide health insurance coverage or pay into make a contribution to a state fund. We have Massachusetts now promising universal coverage through a complex arrangement that includes private insurers. And then there are all kinds of other, I joined an organization called Physicians for a National Health Program, although it was a problem when I had to say my specialty was sociology. I don't think they kind of knew where to put me there. But they, are working on behalf of a single-payer national health plan, very uncompromising, although I think it's a hard road to go because I don't think you can cut out the private insurance industry. So I actually came away feeling more optimistic than I did at the end of my book, but thinking that the action is going to be at the level of the states for a while, and that may be the way we can build universal coverage from the ground up. So, thank you.
We have some time for discussion.
Yeah.
Why did British physicians in 1946-47, when the National Health Service was created, why didn't British physicians mobilize in opposition the way American physicians mobilized against the Truman Plan?
Yeah, and it's true in most other countries, physicians had to be brought on board, and were brought in various ways that and with through compromises, allowing them influence in how the plan was structured, allowing them to be on the boards that would determine services, and that never happened in the U.S. And part of that may be the way our government operates, but physicians weren't. I don't see a lot of evidence. Also, there was big efforts to bring in doctors either. There were these dissident positions, but not. Maybe there was no possibility of negotiating with the AMA. I think that's true also. But I didn't see a lot of effort to do that either.
The American Nurses Association. Association represents a lot more people than the AMA, and you didn't mention nurses in any of this. So nurses and other allied health professionals, where were they when all of the this was going on?
You know, nurses were brought into by when they worked in doctors' offices were brought into the fight against the Truman Plan, but I found some records that the National Nurses Organization supported some idea of universal coverage. I don't think the nurses were opposed, but they were also not in a powerful enough position to really oppose the AMA. But I saw evidence that, small amount of evidence, that the nurses supported some kind of universal coverage. We're not fighting against it. Yeah.
I would like to build on the previous question. You tell us a great deal as to why we don't have a national healthcare system, and you trace the developments from the 1930s down to the present time. I'm wondering what any lessons can you learn from essentially raising a somewhat different question, and doubtless be another book. Why is it that the United States does not have a national healthcare system, unlike your European countries? If you look at Europe in the latter part of the 19th century, virtually every European country has a national healthcare system, and in fact, they go overboard. In Germany, 1884, you have national healthcare. I think 1 or 2 years beyond that, you have Social Security, you have mandatory accident insurance, and so on and so forth. And I'm really wondering whether an analysis of this kind of failure should not sort of have more an even, you know, larger historical perspective and start way back and say, what can we learn from this?
Well, I think, you know, part of what your comment is a comparative issue. And I actually started out with a comparative chapter looking at other countries, but then it got so complicated because then I realized I had to explain each one of the healthcare systems and then talk about how they lost, how you know, physicians lost battles in various countries, and so I ended up just, you know, having a few pages with international comparison. But I think a lot of the history of our health care system has to do with the development of American medicine. And I think the health care system and the health insurance system is so intricately tied up with the development of the history of medicine in the U.S. And you know, the whole irony to me is that the one thing that the AMA fought against most vehemently was any sort of third-party control. And yet when employers were trying to control costs in the 1980s, they turned to managed care, which ultimately was probably worse controls from the position of many physicians of what the government might have put in place in where there might have been more negotiations. So, but that's an interesting.
If I may just follow up on this, I'm wondering what power or influence labor movements had in Europe and more broadly socialist movements. You know, for example, in Germany, the socialist movements had their winds taken out of their sails by essentially Bismarck's concession to socialists to grant them what they were asking for. And so then the question becomes, how powerful relative to what's going on in Europe, where you have a multitude of socialist movements, really, accusing each other of betrayal, as Marx does, of German socialists who buy into this thing. And in the United States, somehow, the same thing does not appear to happen.
Right, that's a classic question by Werner Sombart, Why No Socialism in America? But that is another book.
Is there any validity to the argument that the American medical system develops technologies because of the private funding of medicine, or is that basically just a canard?
Oh, that's a good question. I don't think I can answer it. I mean, I think one of the, you know, the main contributors to rising costs now is the technology. But I don't know if the way we fund it contributes that or not. I'm not sure.
Well, what's your view on whether the states really about Tennessee knows, you know, that the goal of universal coverage is hard to achieve when you have state budget deficit. All of the grand state experiments work well when the economy is good, and then, like in Florida, we've had, you know, a program for people who are uninsurable in the private market, but whenever the economy goes bad, then they close that program to new enrollments. And so I think that's why the federal solution is better than the state solution, because the states fluctuate so much in terms of their capacity to do this. But the state experiments might provide a way where you can show that you've got a cooperative private insurance industry, and you can't just, like, the Physicians for a National Health Program wants to just eliminate the whole private insurance industry. And I, you know, politically, I just don't think that can be done. But the Massachusetts plan is showing a way to hope, maybe, we'll see, cooperate. You know, so if other states adopted it, if this worked and other states adopted, then maybe the federal government, through perhaps Medicaid, could send more money so we could get more universal coverage close to it through a back door. So I do think that's probably for now the greatest possibility.
I haven't been attracted by one of your slides where you have the concept of socialized medicine and the authoritarian regimes which could be. I think this has to be worked out. Let us take an example. I'm a physics professor here and French citizen. Socialized medicine was put on the screen when Hillary Clinton came to France to study the French system of the national security health insurance. So people I was talking in this country about what they asked me what socialized medicine is. And maybe we need to come to facts. Let us say that social security in Europe, France being one example, offers the following. You can go to any doctor in the country. There is no restriction. The concept of primary physician doesn't exist in that system. So is that more socialized medicine, or is that more freedom for the patient?
Right. Well,
so,
you know,
so I'm working on semantics. I think semantics play a major role in distorting the message.
I mean, the idea of socialized medicine, every single proposal from 1900 to yesterday has been called socialized medicine. It doesn't matter what it is. What President Eisenhower was going to do was to basically subsidize the private insurance industry and pay that higher catastrophic, so-called catastrophic cost, which is similar to actually what John Kerry was proposing last election. And the insurance industry didn't want to have to open their books to the government, so they helped kill that. But that was called socialized medicine. And no matter what the plan is, and no matter what plan other countries have, like, you know, Germany, Israel have, it's through employment. That's socialized medicine. The British system, of course, is really socialized medicine, according to the... You know, when I did, you know, one radio show, the first caller got on. This was, I did some, you know, really liberal talk show and some really conservative ones, and one caller got on and said, well, first of all, it's all illegal immigrants that are uninsured, and second of all, this is socialized medicine. So, you know, that theme is there. It doesn't have anything to do with the actual content of what the plan is.
So my main concern is that we need to define terms very exactly on the facts, because...
Right, and that's what, you know, the National Council of Senior Citizens really did with Medicare, was to, you know, get a deserving constituency out there. You know, they had 80-year-old people marching with banners, you know, we need Medicare, telling sad stories of being unable to get care, really working, understanding that they had to counter the image that this was socialized medicine.
politically, how can you embrace such a big, powerful industry? And I just don't think it can be done. I mean, in the recent legislation, the shift is toward trying to bring insurers in more managed care, you know, more HMOs, and I mean the Medicare Modernization Act, the drug bill also is really trying to get more HMOs into Medicare and get people out of the fee-for-service, but the Florida just has new legislation that will let HMOs to participate in Medicaid pick and choose the clients they want to serve, so they could choose to serve children, but not AIDS victims, for instance, whereas in the past, if they wanted to participate in Medicaid, they had to serve all the populations. Now they can pick among them, and that's, you know, 15 new HMOs now have made applications to participate in Medicaid. So I think the trend is towards trying to bring the private insurance industry into the public programs even more, and mainly in the form of some kind of managed care.
I know you've been really helpful. My impression is something that's historically different in the United States is the influence of religious organizations.
Uh-huh.
So I was wondering if you could comment on any evidence.
Yeah, I wrote a different paper that I presented yesterday just because I saw a little bit of evidence in that, but it was something I just couldn't follow up on at the time. But you know, the main concern for religious groups has been, well, in the 40s, Catholic hospitals opposed Truman's plan. I was trying to figure out why that would be the case, and the main issue was the government intervention in the way hospitals were run. You know, and that was also an impediment to Clinton's plan because it included abortion services, and Catholic hospitals didn't want to have to provide abortion. But then also just, you know, physicians, regardless of religion, were over all the groups opposed. But religious groups, you know, do deliver a lot of health services, and I don't have much more detail on that.
I think in the second question, we are now close to 18% of our gross national product for health expenditures, which is almost double what our Western European competitors are spending. So in a globalized economy, American industry and American taxpayers are taking this burden of double the cost of healthcare onto essentially their products and their global competitiveness. So some observers are speculating when they use their crystal ball into the future that national health insurance is going to come from an unlikely source, and that is namely American business. That American business is going to find the cost of healthcare to be so unmanageable and to maintain its global competitiveness that they will push a national program to functionally distribute, as insurance tries to distribute costs of high costs onto the masses. That's sort of the principle of insurance in general. That American business and business leaders and possibly leaders of the Republican Party will actually down the road, be it 5 years, 10 years, simply help preserve the competitiveness of American business. Does that sound remotely plausible?
Yeah, you know, I think in the early 90s, that it was, you know, big auto companies and large manufacturers were really going to talk to Clinton because they felt that the, you know, healthcare costs were a huge problem for them. And right now, the last figure, it was $1,500 were added to the cost of every American produced car because of the health insurance costs that the auto manufacturers have. And the business groups are coming to the table now. They're actually meeting in some states, and there's even a national organization of business leaders trying to say, we've got to do something. The proposals I've seen are relatively modest, kind of tinkering, but there is that concern out there. And I think if there is support to the business community, that's critical, actually. You can't just have total opposition and get anything done. I think Massachusetts involved also brought in business aid.
Take one last question, but before we do, let me remind you we're going to continue the conversation informally upstairs in room 411 starting at 1:10, and there will be a book signing.
offered you one insurance plan. And I've always been perplexed by the notion that the system for federal employees, which my husband has, offers us a choice of like 20 different plans, and I can truly pick whichever insurance company plan I want, which to me is competition. There have been some politicians that have suggested that, you know, this be expanded in one way or another, even Bush did, and I can't understand why they can't sell it, and I wonder, can they not, are they limited in selling it simply because this is the system the government uses, so it must be bad?
Actually, one of the, that was proposed by John Kerry, and one of the sorts of opposition came from Federal Employees Union, who thought that all these sick people would be the ones that would choose to buy into it, and then their health insurance premiums would go up. So you would probably have to create a separate pool for people who would be allowed to buy into the federal employee system.
Everybody?
Yeah, well, it just, yeah, or open it to everybody, but then you have to dismantle all the self-insured company plans and all the, you know, you that's what that path dependency argument. It's not only about opening up a new program, but also dismantling everything that's in place, which many employers are ready to do it, and are doing, actually.
Well, on that hardly optimistic note, thank you all for coming.